good! Stop! Not good! What are you doing? You burned all the food, the shade, the rum!
Yes, the rum is gone.
Why is the rum gone?
One, because it is a vile drink that turns even the most respectable men into complete scoundrels. Two, that signal is over 1,000 feet high. The entire Royal Navy is out looking for me. Do you really think that there is even the slightest chance that they won't see it?
But why is the rum gone?
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Greetings, listeners, and welcome to episode 6 of The Drunken Odyssey with John King. You can find us at thedrunkenodyssey.com. You can like us on Facebook at The Drunken Odyssey with John King, and you can email us at thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. I think that covers all the techie stuff. On today's Odyssey, Yaroslav Kalfar and I will be talking about Stephen King's On Writing. Stephen King is no relation to me, as far as I know. And we will hear from Debbie Weaver talking about Cheryl Strayed's memoir, Wild. So my writing life, like the rest of my life, is pretty much in a holding pattern right now, and as the plane goes around and around the landscape, I've at least taken to printing out some of my writing projects so that I can see them and be reminded that they are there. I did finish a short, I'm not even sure story is the word, but I finished a short piece, and I'm trying to move on to other short pieces.
And now, the interview of the day.
Yaroslav, welcome back to the Whisper Room.
It's good to be here.
Today we're talking about Stephen King's On Writing, which was your suggestion, and you've requested that I start talking about it first. I thought I would begin by talking a little bit about how I feel about Stephen King. Let's get that out of the way. Actually, he was the first grown-up reading I ever did. In middle school, kind of when he became for the first time, the biggest writer on the planet, I discovered some of his novels and became a huge Stephen King fan. And I found by the time I was a freshman in college in 1989, that was about the time Misery came out, I felt like I had outgrown whatever it was that he had to offer me, which is not to say that he doesn't write anything good, but I just felt no longer quite as gripped. And I haven't gone back and reread the old stuff, so I don't know if it's he changed or if it's just I changed, though I suspect it's largely that I changed and became the monster that I am today. And it's not completely a snobbery thing, because I really didn't become a lit person until a few years after that. So it's not a literature, oh, Stephen King writes horror.
Right.
No, I love horror, at least the idea of horror. And give me a good horror movie, and I'm kind of right in there. While I do have a fraught relationship with genre, in no way do I say, oh, he writes in a genre, therefore I don't like that. That's not the way I think. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of curious because I remember reading part of On Writing as far back as the 1980s when he had published part of it in a magazine. I think it was just called Writing. Mm-hmm. And so I had read part of that long ago. And everyone I know who's read this book has really, really liked this book. I was in a craft class in NYU, and someone was bringing up one of Stephen King's points, and the student was hesitant, like, oh, am I allowed to bring this up? And that really broke my heart.
Yeah. Right.
I think whatever it is that you find that helps, that you damn well better be proud of whatever it is that you found that helps, no matter the source, so that if people don't like Stephen King because they have expectations or whatever it is that they're bringing to that, and you find what he says to be useful, well, it's your job to say, well, Stephen King helped me, so the hell with you. Mm-hmm. Anything that you can find that really helps as a writer should be really, really important to you. And you should be proud of whatever wisdom you can find, whatever jewels you can find among different craft sources. So while I'm not sure how I feel about Stephen King's fiction, although I always am very charmed by him when I see him in interviews, mm-hmm. especially in the subject of a novel he wrote as Richard Bachman, in which someone takes over a school. This was pre-Columbine. Someone takes over a school and takes hostages, and it's this nightmare scenario. And then someone reenacted that scenario, and people were mad at Stephen King for inventing the scenario so that a lunatic could take it over. And Stephen King says, well, if they commit a murder or a crime based on something I've written, not only should they be punished for that crime, but they should also be punished for plagiarism. Yeah. And so I have a deep fondness for Stephen King as a man. So that's sort of the cultural baggage in my head just coming to this book. But everyone I know who's read On Writing has been very, very fond of it. And mostly I was fond of it, partly because he says, be honest. That's probably the biggest nugget of wisdom that he has in here for writers is be honest. Don't present what you want the world to be. Don't present a sense of coolness that you want or a sense of professionalism that you want necessarily, but be as honest as you can. And he begins early in the book by saying, this is a short book because most books about writing are filled with bullshit. Mm-hmm. After reading Gardner, who we liked Gardner, and Gardner did not write a long book. The two books are roughly the same length.
Right.
And I don't think that Gardner is filled with bullshit, but Gardner is writing at a very elevated level. And so Stephen King's tone, I felt, was just much more approachable.
Right.
For writers who are maybe in high school and just starting to figure out that they want to write, or even for more advanced writers, it takes a lot of pressure off when you have one of the most persuasive writers in our culture talking in a very plain and honest manner like that. And there's really not enough of that when it comes
that
to
is, that is very true
when we talk about writing. So some of the things that he says like that really charmed me again and reminded me of what I love about Stephen King the man. And at some point I probably should go back and revisit some of the fiction. Mm-hmm. I do remember I got a little ornery because so many of his books seem to be about writers having problems, and I thought that he was maybe getting a little bit too self-involved.
Yeah.
And that was also about the time that he was weaning himself off of alcohol and drugs. So maybe he deserves a second chance there.
Maybe. Well, I'm on the same boat as you when it comes to King. Well, first of all, I have to say that I love genre. Without any embarrassment, without any shame, I grew up on genre. I would never dismiss anybody simply because they are a genre writer. Now, with King, I have to confess I haven't read much of his work. I read about 3 novels of his, which I enjoyed. They were fun works.
Which novels?
I read Misery, It, and The Shining.
Well, reading It should count as more like 3 or 4 novels.
This is very true, yeah. But The Shining was my favorite by far. This was when I was too young to really even think about the difference between literary fiction and genre fiction. So I just sort of read books because they were fun and because it was fun to read them. So I also definitely want to revisit his work, especially after reading on. This is the 3rd time I've read this book, and I adore this book. And like you said, I adore interviews with King, his nonfiction articles that he writes. You know, he writes for the Time magazine, I think. And this book is fantastic, too. I agree that the tone of this book just makes it a delight to read. I mean, Gardner is a little bit of a hassle to get through just because of that elevated tone. He's talking to, the young student, you know, of the craft, whereas King is just like, listen, buddy, you know, let's have a beer and let's talk about what this shit is all about.
Or at least that tone without the beer in his case.
Without the beer. This is true. That is a good point. But I actually had no idea that he went through this long period of drug addiction and alcohol addiction until I read this book. But I guess it makes sense for all the questionable, very questionable novels that he wrote in such a short time.
And he makes, I think, a really important point, which I hesitate to bring up on a podcast like The Drunken Odyssey, and that is he really debunks the myth that there's some essential link between drug use, alcohol use, and creativity.
Right.
I think he's wrong about that. I do think there is a link, but there is also and I think what he's right about is this myth of the writer as the hard-drinking, crazy person, shaman on the edge of society, two stages away from being Jim Morrison, one stage away from being Hunter S. Thompson, is a dangerous model for life.
Yes.
So while I do think that, for example, while I do find drinking to be essential to a good life as I define it, that does not mean that drinking is necessarily essential for anybody else's life. And also, if you're an alcoholic, well, then drinking is only destructive. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I have come across the occasional writer who does not drink, does not do drugs, and I certainly respect that as a point of view, but there are many avenues of life that you simply can't write about persuasively unless you've had some of those experiences.
A little bit of self-destruction helps.
A little bit, yes. Yeah. Now, I heard Toni Morrison once tell someone at a Q&A, don't go looking for trouble. Life will give you plenty of trouble. Mm-hmm. So the idea of courting some mystique of the alcoholic is definitely dangerous behavior.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of people go through that phase in their 20s, and then you kind of grow out of it mostly.
Yeah, it's almost a rite of passage. But the interesting thing about King, and the memoir part of this book is just fantastic, and it's, I think that also it really helps to see where the writer who's telling you what to do came from. You know, where does he get the authority to tell me or to give me any sort of advice? But anyway, he lived a pretty normal life most of his life. He married a girl that he met in college. You know, he didn't whore around or anything like that. They had kids. They had a house. At first, they struggled because they were poor. Then he sold his book. And he continued to be married to this woman all of his life. You know, he raised his kids. They had kids. And he just had a perfectly normal family life. So aside from the drugs and the alcohol, you know, which I guess is a big part of his life, he might as well have been going to an office somewhere and, you know, be an accountant. He didn't have that extraordinary romantic life that we assign to writers so often.
Featuring jail time or things that should have entailed jail time or
engaging in political protest, that sort of thing.
Having surreal adventures in Bolivia.
Getting shot at in South America somewhere, yeah.
Just the beautiful ordinariness, and that sounds dismissive, and I don't mean it to be, the ordinariness of his tone, and also what I like about the narrative of his life, and it doesn't always have to do with writing what he's describing, but what he is describing is how he became who he is, so that he's not starting from the standpoint of Stephen King, multi-millionaire,
right,
who has written 20, 30, 40, I don't even know how many, New York Times bestsellers.
I think it says 30-something on the cover. Yes, more than 30.
More than 30.
Worldwide bestsellers.
Which is a remarkable achievement. And so one of the ways that he's accomplished all that is simply not to be Joe Fabulous Writer, but instead to respect the work and mm-hmm. be just very business-like about the job of writing, which is crucial. The emphasis as a writer has to be on cranking out pages
yes.
and not on living the life of a writer.
Right, because there is no such thing, really. You can live the life of a 20-year-old bohemian, aspiring, starving artist, but that's not necessarily the life of a working writer. Yeah, and he's very straightforward in his instruction to just sit down every day. And I like that he starts with, okay, start with 1,000 words. Like that's some just, you know, it's just some dainty goal that you should up as soon as possible, which 1,000 words a day is what I write now. And it's pretty exhausting to me. But I guess I need to step up my game then. Yeah, he doesn't even discuss that point that much because he's so very clear about it. It's that sit down, type the words, you have the novel, and then you're a writer. you're putting out work, you're a writer. If you're not putting out the work, then you want to be a writer maybe, but...
Well, and I have so little patience for the wannabe writers.
Right.
You know, one of the bars I used to frequent often, the glorious Jet Setter Lounge, I met someone there and the conversation goes through the night. Oh, you're a writer. Yes. Oh, I'm really interested in doing some writing and I was wondering if you could give me some advice. And I said, sure. He goes, well, I've got this idea. And I'm like, that's great. Don't tell me the idea. Go home, take out some paper, write the beginning of the idea, and when you're done, stop, and then maybe show me what you got. Because really, what he's emphasizing, and he doesn't put it in quite these terms, but if you're going to be a writer, you have to love and fully embrace the boring parts of the job.
Right.
And if you can't do that, if you're romanticizing being a writer without somehow your ass sitting in the chair typing out this beast, then that's not really the gig of being a writer.
Right.
You know, it's sort of being a basketball player, but you're too good to practice free throws.
Right.
I just like how cool I look being a basketball player. Well, those aren't going to be talented players. Those are not going to be people with jobs.
Yeah. And that's the cultural image that writers have, is that, you know, I mean, when you watch a movie about writers, obviously the movie can be about a guy sitting on his ass in a chair typing.
Well, so and that is the challenge of every film about writers is how do we actually make that seem interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a conversation we'll have to have sometime soon. Just different,
absolutely.
Different movies about writers and how that image is constructed.
Absolutely.
What was the most interesting thing to you about his practical advice?
I think absolutely. Essentially what we wrote the exercise on is... this idea of a fossil, of, you know, the basic story idea. And you don't outline it. You don't think about it for 3 weeks before you actually start typing words on a page. You just sit down and you start writing about it and you let the character and the situation unfold, which is how I write short stories. And I often feel it's not the quote-unquote correct way of writing short stories. So it's nice to get some affirmation on that. Yeah, I think that's the most interesting thing, because it's impressive that this man can sit down with just an idea in his head and a month or two crank out a novel that will become a bestseller. I guess that also ties into his discipline in editing, because if you write that way, then the editing process really becomes most important, because you are bound to write some crap. If you're just digging around this fossil, you know, I'm trying to think of something clever to say about the fossil, but I can't really think of anything. So if you keep digging, you're going to get some dirt on that fossil. There we go. I got it. So I guess you need to clean the fossil off after you're done with that first draft.
Or I guess you could break the fossil in an extraction process.
Or you could break it, and then I guess you're screwed. So.
Well, revision is magic, though. You can make it look unbroken sometimes.
Ah,
yes.
Okay.
You can fake it. Sometimes.
You can only tell people you only found half of the fossil to begin with. They won't know.
He makes this distinction between story and plot, where he loves story and he's terrified of plot.
Right.
And, you know, the philosopher in me almost wanted him to slow down and actually explain the distinction.
That.
He seems to be defining plot as a series of events, and he doesn't want you to think of these series of events. He just wants you to think of the beginning and then work your way.
Yeah, it seems like almost like he's saying plot is this plan that you come up with in advance, step by step, like this rigid process, whereas story to him is this magical thing that just unfolds by itself if you let it, which could be true. It's put into very plain, romantic words. I think it works sometimes.
Okay, and you felt it worked in your exercise.
I did. Like I told you, I was skeptical about the exercise at first because I thought the setup was ridiculous, and I maybe think that still a little bit. But I actually came up with something significant when I took it seriously. So,
all right, well, let's hear it.
All right. Dick listened to the sound of 96% fat-free popcorn exploding in the microwave as he lifted every cushion and pillow on the couch, looking for the remote. Maximum Overdrive, his favorite awful B-movie inspired by a Stephen King short story, was set to start on Sci-Fi at 9 o'clock. Finally having a night to himself, he wanted the moment opening credits rolled to be perfect. The popping and the quiet cursing under his breath faded into the soundtrack of the local news station, currently reporting on increase in dog euthanasia in the county, result of flood of irresponsible owners who flocked to the newly opened PetSmart in town to purchase purebred mutants who tended to become inconveniently ill a few months into their lives and become perfect candidates for shelter care. This is why he didn't want to get a puppy for Joanna. His little girl was just at the right age to manipulate her father into worshipping at her feet, but he had to set some limits. For a moment, he considered what her mother would have said, but he waved the thought away like a bad dream. The microwave announced its contents were ready. "Aha!" Dick shouted. He held the gray, sticky remote in his hand. As he aimed it at the television set, his finger froze at the sight of the county jail, a fairly small building converted decades ago from a bankrupt bread mill. Dick had a strong personal attachment to this building, or rather, one person involuntarily residing inside of it. "We now interrupt the scheduled news programming to report a jail outbreak in our area. 3 prisoners." Dick stared with his mouth open. 3 prisoners overpowered the guards and got out. 2 were caught immediately. The third, an unidentified woman, managed to escape because she beat the pursuing guard's skull into mash with his own flashlight. The man was in a serious condition, his skull fractured and internal bleeding a possibility. Due to her aggression, the pursued prisoner was flagged as a high risk. Dick held onto his stomach as it bubbled and groaned, his usual reaction to thinking about her. It couldn't be. She was strong, of course, strong enough to overpower a man of his size, but to hurt someone in such a gruesome way, she couldn't have. She was still his daughter's mother. He went to the restroom and emptied the water in his bowels. He was no longer in the mood for popcorn and let it sit in the microwave. 5 minutes until maximum overdrive. He switched the channel to Sci-Fi and grabbed a bottle of whiskey from the cabinet. He poured a glass with drops of club soda and returned to the couch. His daughter was having fun at a sleepover. He had the house to himself. He promised he wouldn't give a shit, and so he wouldn't. A sound came from the stairs. He spilled a bit of whiskey on his chest and set the glass on the floor. He stared toward the dark stairway, regretting he had shut off all the lights in the house. It couldn't have been steps, impossible. Just a house settling in. Cats on a roof. Birds mating. The air conditioning unit turned on, and the cold breeze raised the last flaccid bit of hairs on the back of his head. With the breeze came a familiar smell. Dick was happy he had gone to the bathroom. Certainly, this aroma would have made him piss himself. Apple and cucumber shampoo and honey conditioner. He had buried his nose into the hazel hair infused with this scent for years. Certainly, she was the kind of woman who would make sure she had her shampoo even in jail. It was there. He was certain now. She was hiding in the darkness of the stairs, waiting. "Jane?" he called out. No answer. He stood up, raised the remote as if it could become a weapon. He looked around. The closest sharp object was in the kitchen. Not like he could stab her anyway. Not that he was ever able to defend himself or his daughter from her brutality. She called the shots. She sniffed out the coward in him, the helpless little man intoxicated by women who agreed to love him. "Jane?" he said, louder. "Baby," she responded. She emerged out of the shadows, wearing an orange jumpsuit torn in few places. He could see the skin of her stomach, some of her thigh, bruised and cut up. A black spot underlined her eye, the only part of her that seemed fairly untouched, slightly tangled, a leaf sticking out in the back, was her hair, as healthy and rich as he could remember, the color matching her hazelnut eyes. He was disturbed by his own romanticized assessment of her looks as she stood above him, an escaped convict, holding the gun he had usually kept upstairs in his closet. "You still keep your gun in the same place," she said. She did not move. "Jane," he said. "Last time you pointed it at me and said you'd kill me right there in front of our daughter. Said you knew she'd understand someday that I had to be out of your lives. Remember?" "Yes," he said. "The cops came and took me away. You didn't get your chance." I didn't want to do it, he said. I stabbed you in the leg in front of your daughter. You really didn't want to? Maybe. I don't remember, he said. She walked over and handed the gun to him. He hadn't touched it since the night he pointed it at her face. That night, he was fragments of a second away from pulling the trigger, blowing her existence out of his life. She was right. He wanted to, more than anything. Do it now, she whispered. She leaned toward him, placed her forehead on the tip of the gun. He hugged the trigger with his thumb. He expected her eyes to be deranged, smile crooked. He expected to see the devil or demons or some kind of an evil influence to give him permission, to give him mandate to take her life. He didn't see anything, only the brown eyes of a woman he used to kiss on the forehead and take long walks with. Before the fights, before the violence, just the girl. He pulled the trigger anyway. Nothing happened. If you held it more often, you'd know it's heavier when it's loaded, she whispered again. She put her hands on his, gently. All this time in jail, I've wondered. I had to figure it out. I wanted you to know, too. This is the kind of man you are. The kind who pulls the trigger, she said. She kissed the hand that still held the gun, thumb cramping up while still pulling on the limp trigger. Then she got up and walked out of the house. Dick stood up and walked into the kitchen. His hand still shaking, he put the gun on the counter. He reached for the bottle of whiskey, took a glass out of the cabinet, and poured. He didn't stop until the top overfilled. He drank it in two gulps, and another. The next morning, he would pick his daughter up from school and take her to daycare. He would call out of work and go to the nearest shooting range. He would feel the heaviness of a loaded gun in his hands and shoot it into paper targets for hours. He would have a drink afterwards. He would empty the cartridge one bullet at a time until he was convinced of the truth she had shown him, the kind of man he is, the kind of man who pulls the trigger.
All right, so I suppose it's my turn now?
Yes.
Richard flopped into the camp chair in the backyard. The high stucco walls, lined with ivy, placed a private hush across the lawn. The neighborhood mowers and even the chittering birds in a nearby oak came as muted impressions. He read a few pages of Stephen King's On Writing, but his mind wandered from the words to the lizards in the grass, the mountainous clouds hovering in the almost turquoise Florida sky. Richard's thoughts were slackly wired. Nell was at Hunter's birthday party, and would be picked up by his parents early in the evening. Jane was where she was for the next 8 years if she exhibited good behavior. Relax, Richard told himself. The air conditioner's motor came on, adding its droning to the afternoon. When he drove into this development an hour ago, the security guard leaned out of his shack and said, "Have a blessed day." Richard felt chilled by this greeting, even though he had heard the man say this before, on earlier vacations. Surely the man had said the phrase, with that beaming smile, hundreds of times today, thousands of times this month. What did the phrase mean? Could this man see the scars on Richard's neck? Did the guard know how much in need Richard was of blessing? The phrase served like another wall, keeping whoever the guard was separate from the world. As Richard swiped a security card by the scanner, the air conditioning of his car and the malevolent summer humidity created a sickening meteorological disturbance that lasted until the driver's side window sliced up again into the door. The security barrier swooped up, and Richard revved the Volvo inside. Richard heard a tiny splat. He looked down at the page. Another splat. A sweat droplet splattered the text of Stephen King getting stung by wasps as a child. Richard held the book away from his lap. He could feel layers of sweat beading upon and then oozing down his face. His shirt was already drenched. He sat there a moment, breathing the humidity, slowly. Then he peeled himself from the chair and lurched to the sliding door. Once inside, he took his shirt off, dropped it on the beige carpet. He went into the closet, fetched out a towel, and sat down on the couch. He swiped his chest and back with a cloth, feeling more chills from the air conditioning. Then he turned on the television. The dimpled chin of a newscaster was presented on Channel 2, the local station that only reported the events of this community nonstop, in an existential loop. Mr. Reginald Johnson scored a 295 in bowling yesterday, a best at the Hacienda House League this year. The news didn't matter to Richard at all, except that it pointed to lives that seemed so much easier than his own, at least easier than it had been this last year. He wanted to get drunk. He wanted to have sex or get a massage or watch some pornography. He wanted to feel like himself again. But Nell would be home in a few hours, and he didn't want to be that sort of father. She had gone through enough with Jane. Even though he felt shallow, nothing more than a mask of a good father, just an impulse to protect his daughter, he could not let go of the mask. Marjorie Hawkins is making quilts for the troops overseas, the newscaster said. From the living room, Richard heard the gears and the groaning metal of the garage door opening. It was hours before Nell was set to come home. Richard looked for his phone, but it wasn't on the coffee table. The noise stopped, and then the sound went in reverse as machinery of the garage door dully squealed back down. The kitchen door that opened onto the garage swung open. Jane traipsed inside, wearing only a bikini and flip-flops. "Hi, honey," she beamed. "I just knew you'd come back to this place." Richard clutched his neck as she passed through the kitchen and the dining room into the living room. The vertical blinds cast bars of shadows across her exposed skin. "Brr," she said, embracing herself, which jostled the weight of her breasts. "Jane," Richard said. The towel dropped to the carpet. "I'm so sorry," she said, kneeling before him, "for everything you've been through, darling." "Jane, what are you doing here?" A tear beaded at the corner of her eye and then dropped onto the swell of her cleavage. Richard gazed into her eyes, which were only about 10 inches from his own. "Show me your hands," he said. Jane uplifted them. There were scratches all over the tendons of her fingers across the backs of her hands. But her fingers looked perfectly smooth and felt perfectly smooth as she caressed Richard's thighs with them. "Darling," she said. "How did you get here?" Richard said. "I was being transferred from the county correctional facility," she said, "to the psych center. There was an accident. All these sparks on the road. I've never seen anything like it. I hit my head, but managed to get out of there. The bus was ripped open like a tin can." "And how did you get these clothes?" "I walked into a Family Dollar store and shoplifted them. They're worth maybe $6, but it got me out of that god-awful jumpsuit. In the store, I tried to look like an astronaut who was lost." "This isn't funny," said Richard. "Of course it isn't, darling. This is impossible." "I quite agree." "I love you so much," she said. What am I going to do with you?" "Why, anything you want, darling," Jane said, sliding her arms around his back. "I think I need to call the police." Jane placed her head into his chest. "Don't leave me," she said. "Haven't I been through enough? It was so hard to get here." "Jane." She kissed him. Despite himself, Richard kissed her back. He shoved her down onto the floor, held her wrists to the carpet. Her feet hooked behind the muscles of his lower back. She raised her face towards his, her lips fiercely pursed. He kissed her hard, pushing her head down. Her tongue tantalized until she moved her head to the side. Jane breathed into his ear. He ground his pelvis against hers. "You and me," she whispered. Jane's polyester bra was askew. With one hand pinning one of her wrists, Richard's other hand explored her body. "You and me and Nellie," she said, "in Paraguay." "What?" said Richard, gripping one of her hips. "Well, first Mexico," Jane said, "but ultimately Paraguay. What are you talking about?" "It's the only way, darling," she said, her free hand skimming up his chest. "I've thought this through, and that is the best plan." "You're," Richard said. Jane's fingers caressed the side of Richard's neck. "You need me," she said. "You know you need me." Richard kissed her hard again. His hands were around her throat. He was squeezing so hard his whole body quaked. Jane's mouth sputtered with gagging sounds. Her feet dropped to the carpet, her legs squirming. She looked up at Richard, her eyes open and naturally wide. She blinked spastically. her eyelashes thick with tears. But her hands reached up to stroke his back, from his shoulders to his hips, and then his hips to his shoulders, with her silky fingers. The skin of her face was graying in the bars of the sunlight that came through the verticals. Jane stopped gurgling. She blinked and blinked, and looked up at Richard with a frail smile. Richard was screaming. He let go, jumped up, staggered over to the dining room table. Spots were popping up in his vision, flaring into the relative darkness away from the sliding glass door. He was shaking. All of his muscles were burning. He leaned onto the table, dropped his head down onto the oak. Richard might have been crying or laughing. A shrill subterranean wheezing sounded to his right. Jane was clutching her throat. Her face was tinged light blue. As she inhaled a painfully sustained breath, her chest inflated, making her disheveled bikini seem obscenely wrong. After some more breaths, Jane turned on to her side, curled up her body, facing away from Richard. Richard stood there, his hand leaning on the table. Stabbing pains were inching into his cerebellum. He clutched his sweaty hair around his temples. His pulse leapt out of his skin. Jane's body was convulsing, in arrhythmic spasms, with sobs that emerged from her mouth as a series of croaks and rasps. Richard looked down at her. One of her cheap pink flip-flops was across the room, beneath the glass end table, a cartoon footprint. Her hair was sweaty and sticking to her heaving back. Her bikini bottom revealed the beginning of a crevice of flesh. Richard watched his wife breathe and cry a long time. The sun was descending behind the high stucco walls outside, with only a grayish pink aura left in the sky. The shadow of the blinds evened out into a more general dimness. Jane taught herself how to breathe. She stood up and yanked off the cords of triangular fabric of her bikini until she stood before him, naked, sweaty and heaving. Her eyes glinted at Richard as the house darkened some more, as their pupils dilated to focus in the darkness. "You," said Jane, "you'll never know how much I love you." "I'm beginning to believe you," said Richard. "Do I have any clothes here?" Jane asked. "Actually, yes," he said. "We can leave tomorrow." "Will the police not follow you here?" Richard asked. "Nellie will be home soon," said Jane, embracing herself. "Yes, she will," said Richard. And then he thought to himself, "I don't have much time," as he went into the kitchen to get the carving knife from the drawer. All right, we are back in interview mode. All right, so talk to me about the trials, tribulations, and whatnot of doing the exercise.
Well, like I said before, I did not like the premise. It seemed very genre horror-like premise, but not in a good way. It seemed very cookie-cutter, stereotypical person in a house alone situation. And the jailbreak seemed far-fetched.
And I don't mean to sound sexist, but when we flipped the genders, it seemed even more far-fetched to me.
No, it's like, true.
Secretly, Jane, as a teenager, studied to be a ninja. Yeah. So, I mean, it really took on sort of some – now, even Michael Bay would somehow try to make that more believable, I think.
It's true. So the figuring out how to treat the breakout, I think, was the biggest thing for me. And I just decided, well, this is a crazy premise to begin with. I'm just going to go crazy with it. And I really, at the beginning, I had no idea what I was going to do, you know, where this was going to go. So I thought, okay, guys, what does a guy do when his daughter is away for a night? You know, he's alone in a house. Stephen King suggested the character drinks herbal tea to calm himself. Well, that's not what a man does, to calm himself. He pours whiskey, you know, he'll eat some junk food.
A man who's not a recovering alcoholic will go to the whiskey rather than the tea.
That is correct, yeah. So, you know, he will make some junk food, he will watch a crappy movie, and he will drink whiskey. You know, that to me is what the character would do. So I started there.
Well, I think Maximum Overdrive is much maligned. I think it's a gorgeously goofy movie.
I don't know. I can't even really make fun of it because my friends and I have these movie nights when we watch just terrible movies and we make up drinking games, you know, to go along with them, and it's a good time. We did not have a good time with that movie. It was just too much.
I would argue because it's actually a good movie.
I don't know. We should have a conversation about that sometimes because I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Okay, but we're digressing from, right. I think, the larger point, which is you felt you needed to tweak parts of the scenario you were given because it didn't seem realistic, honest, or workable to you.
The details didn't seem honest. Yes, that is correct.
I do remember when he said, "Doesn't that sound like a great idea?" And I just remember screaming, "No, that sounds like a horrible idea. And it's nothing I would ever think to write because it just doesn't seem to reveal life as I know it at all." Although I think I eventually got there with the assignment. Yeah, I remember the initial premise. I rebelled at that, and then you rebelled at that kind of, yeah, at the same point in the writing process.
Yeah. Yeah, but eventually, you know, I thought, well, the wife needs a motive for breaking out in the first place. And I thought about going with it where you went with it. You know, she wants to take them away, but it didn't catch me enough. It didn't, you know, motivate me enough to actually sit and write this assignment instead of working on my novel or working on my story. So then I came up with, okay, she wants to see who her husband is because he pointed a gun in her face, was about to kill her, and she wants to see if he is really that kind of a man or not.
And ironically, the man she would respect is the one who would shoot her in the face, but there would be no more her to respect that man.
Right.
The way both of us went, yours doesn't have any violence, and mine has one violent moment, but no blood, no decapitations, no gunfire.
Right.
And I hint at violence to come. And I wasn't even sure I liked that ending. My wife was fond of it. She thought that the way it ended was an ideal ending, but I wanted to end it just with, you'll never know how much I love you. And he says, "I'm starting to believe you."
And I agree with that. I think that Stephen King would approve of the ending that you have now.
And I sort of felt like I had, yeah, to live up to the expectations of the exercise, that I sort of needed to find a violent, satisfactory ending to the thriller scenario that I was given. But both of us went, I think, towards the psychodynamics of whatever was going on. I felt a need to change Dick's name because I had to refer to his neck and I was not going to say Dick's neck. Just not going to do it.
Okay.
I could not live with myself if I wrote the phrase Dick's neck.
That's pretty bad.
I also found the jailbreak to be incredibly problematic, so I didn't really bother to make it. Well, first of all, that it's reported on the news, I could not make myself do that at all. And then, yeah, I sort of treat it just enough so that you maybe believe that it happened without going into details, because I think the more, the more complicated the lie, the more it seems like a lie. So I kind of treated the jailbreak like it's the least interesting part of the story.
Yeah, I saw it as an opportunity maybe to set up the wife's violent nature without having to go into flashbacks of what she had done in the past, you know. So it's like, well, this woman is capable of bashing someone's head in with a flashlight, so beware. I like the use of sexuality in your piece. I thought about going there, but I got lazy, so I didn't.
Well, I don't feel comfortable with pure victims. And of course, I think as well, your character, you know, is not a pure victim.
Right.
Or if he is, he's not happy morally with his status as being the pure victim in this situation. And so, yeah, I think we live perhaps in a more morally ambiguous worldview than Stephen King seems to be supposing here. Not that his characters are perfect, but, you know, I do think that the more casual genre version of the story would probably be focused more on how do you get the knife? How do you get the weapon?
Right.
How do you get the croquet mallet? How do you get the thing that someone's going to hurt someone with?
Yeah. It'd be more like this woman needs to be killed because she's bad and this guy needs to do it because he's good. And how does he do it? Is it a...
Yeah. And so the idea of, for example, the man in The Shining, what if he doesn't die a maniac in the end? What if this guy is just a raging asshole that you actually have to live with?
Right.
Which is a lot closer to real life, or at least life as I know it. But then again, you know, I think this does point out, again, Stephen King's own life, which seems to have been a fairly decent one. Maybe one we should aspire to, but I've known life to be far more morally ambiguous than that.
Right.
And so,
well, you can't, in real life, you can't always shoot or otherwise kill the asshole that's stalking you or making your life miserable.
Well, it's...
So, I think there is more horror in that situation when you have to actually deal with that person, like you said.
And it's not as satisfying necessarily to read in a story, but on the other hand, yeah, if it feels too convenient...
Yeah, I guess it depends what you're looking for in the story, because I do find that more satisfying. You know, the complexity of a situation like that, a woman can't escape from a man who's stalking her, you know, he's just always there. The law is not sufficient to deal with it. Instead of her being able to just cut his throat or something and be rid of him.
Yeah, instead it's a problem that never goes away.
Yeah.
But if it never goes away, then you've got some never-ending existential novel, so
right.
You need to find a way to...
There is a good way to treat that. Have you read or seen The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
It is on my to-do list. It's in the pipeline. But
okay.
No, I've not yet either read the novels or seen any of the films.
Well, I guess I can't. This happens early on, but I still don't know if I can spoil it for you or not. But it is an important point. It would really help this conversation.
Well, you better go ahead then.
Since, okay.
It's been around and a big deal for... many years.
This is
so,
true. You need to catch up with
that. It's my fault if you're going to spoil it for me. So go ahead.
Okay, so the main character, Elizabeth, is raped by the man who's... Essentially, she's a reformed criminal. She, you know, she was in prison when she was younger, and now she has a caretaker who takes care of her finances, who checks up on her, you know, a state-appointed watchdog, essentially. And this guy... And at first forces her to give him oral sex in exchange for money that is hers. And then eventually he lures her into his apartment and brutally rapes her. Eventually, Lisbeth catches him in his apartment. She lures him and she knocks him out. And then she shoves a dildo up his butt and makes him watch the whole rape because she recorded the rape. Managed to do that at least. So she makes him watch it, you know, while she smokes a cigarette in the next room. And then she tattoos, "I'm a rapist pig," on his stomach. And that I find extremely satisfying because this guy now has to live his whole life with this incredible humiliation, you know, and with the tattoo, which she says she's going to be monitoring him. And if she sees that he tries to get it removed, she'll come back and, you know, do more things to him. So I find that much more satisfying for the audience to be like, oh, you know, shit, this guy has to deal with this for the rest of his life versus just killing off the bad guy, you know, or doing something like that. So
there are ways to deal with it in which the wounds don't necessarily heal.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least quite so neatly. You know, oh, I've killed the bad guy. The antidote has been taken.
Yes.
What else did you notice working on the exercise?
What else did I notice?
The big thing was Stephen King seemed to be right in that you begin with a scenario and then you see
mm-hmm.
where it takes you. Although it does seem like you had ideas for where it would go and you said, no, I'm going to go this way rather than that way.
Right. But it didn't come from like, you know, okay, I have this planned out. You know, this happens now, this happens now, this happens now, this is the end. I thought, okay, well, there are two ways to go here. You know, and I like this way better, so I'll go this way, but I have no idea what happens beyond that. And that's, like I said, that's how I work on most of my short stories. I just have no idea how that would work for a novel, for such a long, sustained project. So that's something I have to try out, I guess, and see if King's theory works on that for me, too.
Yeah, I highly doubt that works. Now, E.L. Doctorow, who is definitely firmly established in the literary firmament...
Mm-hmm.
actually believes the same thing, that you can only know, like, the next, you know, he describes it as night driving, and you can only see 50 feet in front of you. But after you travel 50 feet, you can see the next 50 feet in front of you, so that you don't need to know the entire itinerary of your, you know, evening's journey, that you can write a whole book that way. And I find that when I try to do that, that I wind up in a roller coaster car coated in Jell-O somewhere in Tijuana. And my story does not actually function that way. But if we want to look for people who agree with Stephen King, well, there's E.L. Doctorow, who's no slouch.
Right.
Although his literary career and Stephen King's literary career also started a goodly while ago. And so if E.L. Doctorow had to come on the scene now today, I'm not sure that the sort of plots that he writes would work. Stephen King certainly writes different plots than E.L. Doctorow. Stephen King's are shorter chapters and work within genre expectations, whereas Doctorow's, it's more like you're implanted into a world very often.
Well, Ray Bradbury is another giant who believes in this method of night driving. I get that. I like that term, by the way. I think I'm going to use it from now on. The method I use right now is kind of a combination of night driving and for the novel that I'm working on. I guess essentially what I borrowed from screenwriting is, for each scene you write character's motivation, where it is at the beginning of the scene and then where it is at the end of the scene. You know, what does the character want in the scene? Does he get it? What happens in the end? And that's how I structure my novel outlines, is for each chapter I write, okay, character X wants this at the beginning, and where does he end at the end of this chapter? And that's how I treat it. So it's a very basic outline. You know, I don't write long pages for each chapter or anything, because that just seems like a waste of time to me when I could actually just be writing the actual novel. So,
well, I have tried writing a general overview of what I think the plot will be, and then find that I morphed into just writing the actual story so that I could basically, after a certain point, copy what I had written and then paste it as the actual work itself. But when I found that I was getting caught up, that I couldn't make any progress forward, that I could, in fact, say, never mind actual narration, let me just describe big picture what I think is going to happen.
Yeah.
And sort of trick myself into getting some forward momentum there. But I found that I needed to chew on Stephen King's homework for a while before I could actually start writing, because I hated the scenario. And I'm actually fairly pleased with what I wrote, despite the fact that I felt like I really wrestled with, how do I take the scenario that I don't value and find something to value in it? For me, it was the codependent relationship and the implications that this innocent man who's trying to be a good dad really doesn't have much humanity left. And you could sort of see how he's being infected by this person who is stalking him.
Right.
And how all the good options, all the sane, civilized options just don't seem to be there anymore. So that even if he accomplishes the killing of his wife, you don't get a sense that things are going to be much better.
Right. And that's a very postmodernist take on it, I think. And I don't think King expected that necessarily when he assigned the exercise. So.
Well, I'm torn. I don't know if we should send him our exercises. He said send the exercises to StephenKing.com.
But this was what, like 20 years ago? 10?
Closer to 10.
Yeah. Let's see.
But then again, he knew the book would stay in print. He certainly is inviting us. So I felt that in taking the time to figure out how to actually cope with these materials and find some value in them, that I did basically plot out what would happen. And it wasn't, I didn't plot out every second of it. It was a fairly organic process, but it was a little bit like Gardner, like, okay, like, what's everyone's motivation? And then how do I get them all in the same place?
So you'd say you designed plot points from the beginning to end and then just sort of connected the dots as you improvised, or?
I think the word plot points might be strong.
Okay.
I mean, it's six pages. But I did see him attacking her without it being the convenient conclusion. And I also knew that there had to be an attempt of a reckoning between them, that it was, the psychology was way more important than whatever violence might happen.
Right.
And my own instinct is to normally push the sex and violence pretty far. And here I felt like, and I'm not exactly sure why, other than I do think I kind of had Stephen King looking over my shoulder while I was writing this. that I sort of pushed it a little, but I didn't really make it go as far as it could have gone. Mm-hmm. Also, I needed to make sure I could wrap it up in about 6 pages, which is
right.
The page limit he gave. But I did feel like the major movements, okay. Parts of it I felt pretty good about, like, oh, the garage door. I'm like, okay, that's creepy. That'll stay. That feels creepy without being cliche yet, I think. It's a very domestic noise, the sound of a garage door opening. All right, so I feel like we've talked at length about not very much of this book, actually.
This is true.
I do think that his advice about using the first word that comes into your mind more often than not is a good one.
I agree with that.
And I know a lot of young writers struggle with this because they want to sound especially literary or they want to be taken seriously. So they try too hard. And if you want to try too hard, crank out pages.
Right.
But don't struggle to find the most interesting word in the Oxford English Dictionary at your disposal. And, of course, I seem like probably a really bad person to offer such advice since my own style tends to be over the top and hyperbolic. But at the risk of sounding like a total jerk, those are the first words that come to mind when I'm writing. But I come from a background of Joyce, Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Virginia Woolf, and many other writers who just come from an incredibly literary background. And so I think every year that passes, I get a little bit more relaxed with that. But still, yeah, you shouldn't be torquing your style to impress people.
Right. Yeah, no, it's with English being my second language, I never felt like I had something to prove on that front because my vocabulary will never be as good as that of a person who writes and who has been speaking English all their lives. So that never was a worry for me. And I think it's kind of enlightening once you let go of that. You know, it allows you to just say whatever the hell it is that you're trying to say instead of trying to sound smart and make that a part of your style. Because writers do that, young writers. Making themselves look smart as the writer, as the narrator, they try to make that a part of their personal style, and it's not. It's not a part of style at all.
Yeah, it's a fishing about for a style rather than an actual style.
Right.
And so some of the very basic things, read Strunk and White, yes, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
Emphasis on active verbs, yes. Grammatical competence, and that's one of those moments when I feel like, okay, maybe this book isn't for me because I've been teaching grammatical competence for almost 20 years now.
Right.
So I don't quite feel like, that advice is for me anymore at that point. I have that. Mm-hmm. Simple taglines for dialogue, that's another crime that young writers very often perpetrate against their readers, is trying to torque how you identify dialogue.
Yeah.
We just want to know who's saying what. And we kind of filter out the word said. So it's not like we read it and go, oh, we're bored because we've seen said too many times. We don't care. We're focusing in on what was being said, not how it was being said. And he is right, too, that if what is being said in dialogue is good enough, we will have a pretty good idea of how it was said.
Right.
Too.
Absolutely.
He tells people to avoid adverbs. I had one on page one. But he does not, I think, sufficiently explain why.
He just seems to have a very personal dislike of them.
And if you pick your verbs carefully, so here's me offering further advice off Stephen King. If you choose your verbs wisely, then adverbs are a waste of time. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of adding empty calories because you didn't do a good enough job in the first place.
That is true.
Having said that, the right adverb every once in a while tends to be funky and interesting.
It can, yeah.
But
and he catches himself using an adverb, too, in the book. So, you know, even people who absolutely despise them use them occasionally to spice up their language. So,
and he feels guilty whenever he finds that he's written one. And he does admit, and I thought this was also wonderful, that he doesn't always follow his advice. And he knows he's breaking a rule and he just lets it lie sometimes. That he really liked something that he wrote and if it breaks a rule and he's leaving it. Kill your darlings is a pretty good piece of advice. Mm-hmm. Don't be precious about writing and keep your eye on the big picture, which is having a story that's worth telling. And, oh, I really like this chapter where I describe stamp collecting. No.
Nobody's interested in that.
Well, Nicholson Baker maybe, but many people.
Not many people.
And unless you're the first person ever to write about stamp collecting.
It's kind of like Franzen's writing about birds in Freedom. It's just, I'm sorry, I'll confess I skipped those parts. After a while, I just learned, okay, we're talking about birds again. I'm just going to go ahead and skip this paragraph because you can tell that it's a personal passion of the writer, you know. And it's beautiful that he has all this knowledge of birds, but people who aren't similarly inclined to care about birds will just, okay, get back to the character, you know, get back to the story. So,
huh. I don't remember that being a problem when I read
really
Freedom. I guess that's...
Well, good for you then.
But even from a fairly sophisticated reader then, yeah, however long he did go on about birds was apparently too long.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let your research bully your writing is another important thing to keep in mind.
The story, yeah.
Which I don't think Stephen King went too much into.
No.
But his advice about the toolbox was very good. So while I think that this is mostly for very young writers and starting writers, you know, I love his tone, and it was a very personable book, which is, I think, rare for books on craft.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, is his biggest accomplishment with this.
I agree with that. Absolutely.
And now, a book discussion. A book that saved my life.
Closer to Shore by Debbie Weaver.
For the past 15 months, I am confused, lost, and doing the best I can. It feels like I'm treading water, and no matter how hard I try, how hard I think about propelling my body into a freestyle motion and heading for the shore, I am stuck. It isn't like I haven't tried to swim. I have. But each attempt, each invitation I accept to go anywhere, to do anything, to be with new friends, to be with old friends, leaves me feeling empty, and afterwards I feel worse than if I just stayed at home alone. I keep treading because I do know I don't want to drown. I stretch my arms, gently moving the water back and forth, looking out at the narrow beach far away, unsure when I will ever get out of the deep water. My real solace comes from books. I eat them like mini Snicker bites, devouring as many as possible in a week. I see them as collectively giving me a clue as to where I need to go, what I need to do with the rest of my life now that I've survived cancer, now that I'm attempting to survive a failed marriage. A friend and fellow writer tells me about a new book titled Wild by Cheryl Strayed. Read it, she says. It's fabulous. So I go to the bookstore, flip open the inside hard jacket and read. The story of an 1,100-mile solo hike that broke down a young woman reeling from catastrophe and built her back up again. I snap the front cover shut and place the book back on the shelf. Why do I want to read about a woman stupid enough to take off on the Pacific Crest Trail by herself? I don't want to read 311 pages about hiking. I walk outside, and the hot Florida sun beats hard on my back. I reach the car, sigh, and turn to go back inside to purchase a book. I purchase it because I trust my friend as a reader. I trust her as a writer. I take Wild home and don't pull it out of the bag for a few more days. Then, one night I begin to read. In the prologue, Strayed writes, I was living alone in a studio apartment in Minneapolis, separated from my husband, and working as a waitress, as low and mixed up as I'd ever been in my life. Each day I felt as if I were looking up from the bottom of a deep well. But from that well, I set about becoming a solo wilderness trekker. I read a bit further, and she writes this on the morning she intends to start her journey. When I woke up the next morning in my room at White's Motel, I showered and stood naked in front of the mirror, watching myself solemnly brush my teeth. I tried to feel something like excitement, but came up with a morose unease. Every now and then I could see myself, truly see myself, and a sentence would come to me, thundering like a god into my head. And as I saw myself then, in front of that tarnished mirror, what came was the woman with a hole in her heart. That was me. In that single phrase, Strayed and I became friends. The next day, it rains a thundery downpour, the kind that saturates the ground and causes swells of water in the backyard. I stay in bed and continue to read, mesmerized, unable to convince myself of doing anything else except to brew a pot of coffee. I follow Strayed on this journey, this hiking trail from the Mojave Desert to Washington State. I meet her siblings, her husband, her stepfather, her new friends along the trail. I watch her get up every morning and go to bed every evening. I'm captured by her grit, her determination, her uncomplicated realization that all she has is the day before her. She doesn't quit because she's cold or runs into bears and rattlesnakes, or is overcome by the weight of her backpack that she affectionately nicknames Monster. She doesn't quit when she runs out of money, or when she has to leave her campsite and walk most of the night, having to feel her way through the woods because it is so dark, because she needs to get away from two seedy men with unspoken yet dangerous intentions. Cheryl Strayed doesn't know what will happen the next day or the day after as she hikes, but she continues to move forward with her goal of making it to the Oregon Skyline Trail. I close the book, finishing it in one day. I am profoundly moved by her vivid, blunt prose. I go back and reread a few chapters, now paying attention to the craft, how each sentence is constructed without any waste. I read lines like the following several times over. It seemed like a miracle that I had finally had the river in my sights, as if a newborn baby had just slipped finally into my palms after a long labor. That glimmering dark water was more beautiful than anything I'd imagined all those miles I'd hiked to reach it. Strayed's writing is raw, emotional in a way that picks you up and takes you on the trail, like it or not. I rest the book on my nightstand and close my eyes. It is late, and I hear the rain still pelting outside my window. I think about how I've been treading water, how I'm stuck because I keep searching for answers I don't have at the moment, answers I think I need to move me closer to the shore. I think of how I almost didn't read this book, how I forcefully put it back on the shelf. I smile, glad that I trusted my writer friend. I wish I could tell you that reading Wild gave me the answers I was looking for, that I'm in the process of selling my house, quitting my job, in order to hike the Appalachian Trail in search of my own discovery. No, that's not my plan. That's not my story. But Cheryl Strayed did confirm that I don't have to have all the answers before moving forward, before moving closer to the shore. I just need to swim, ever so slowly, and trust that the answers will come.
And now, the Drunken Odyssey mailbag.
So on the last mailbag, Monica Lumen Garcia asked what adult beverage goes with your top 10 recommended books, and I deferred to answer until this week. Monica, are you trying to kill me, dear? Maybe you could have asked for 5. Okay, here's 10. Number 1, A Disturbance of One Place by Benny Kirschenbaum. Benny Kirschenbaum is one of my favorite writers, with her delicious first-person narrators and stories of amoral innocence. It's as if she writes literary crack. I so want that to be on a book blurb someday. I find her books immensely difficult to put down, and I recommend this one because it was my first of hers. Oh, you always remember your first. The narrator of this novel undertakes 3 separate affairs as she describes the cracks and the fictions with which we build the social fabric, all the while pondering the Talmudic wisdom, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. Benny Kirschenbaum is the most underrated writer in America today. While reading A Disturbance in One Place, you should drink espresso and then brandy. 2. Chang and Eng by Darren Strauss. This is one of those books that saved my life. While I was involved in the existential problems of, let's say, a difficult relationship, this novel let me escape into the first-person perspective of Eng, one half of the conjoined twins, that made the term Siamese twins synonymous with conjoined twins. These two brothers lived rich and full lives, lives of dignity despite their great otherness to Americans and the inescapability of the presences of each other, in which privacy was nearly impossible. The sex scene is pretty incredible, too. While reading Chang and Eng, I recommend Bombay and Tonic. This may seem to stretch the Orient too far, but then again, I've never found Thai liquor before. Bombay and Tonic it is. 3. And the next three have a related theme. Okay, 3. The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon. This recent masterpiece, winner of the 2001 Pulitzer Prize, tells the story of the golden age of comic books in which a Jewish refugee from Germany helps create the iconography of a superhero that helped America imagine the defeat of the Nazis. This novel captures perfectly both the vibrant goofiness of comic books with the reverberations of the subtext that comic books, when they work, tap into. It's a work of realism and postmodernism grandeur, and it saved my life about a year before Chang and Eng did. I read much of this novel while nursing a broken heart at the Ritz-Carlton in Philadelphia while I was avoiding the MLA conference. What to drink? Classic martini. The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Juno Diaz. This novel, winner of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize, whirls together the mythical strains of science fiction, fantasy, and comic book stories to explore the magnitude of both a fat nerd's imagination and the colossal sublime terror of dictatorship, in this case the rule of Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. This is a complex, epic novel that contains so much humanity, humility, and hope. What to drink? What do nerds drink? I don't know. Rum and Coke? Rum and Coke. Men in Cartoons by Jonathan Lethem. This is my favorite short story collection in contemporary literature, although the collected Amy Hempel or the collected Laurie Moore are also great. These 9 stories are perfect meditations and stories that explore so many aspects of men's relationships to superheroes. Some stories are realist, others are fantastical, such as Super Goatman, and some are postmodern, such as the dystopianist, thinking of his rival, is interrupted by a knock on the door. These stories are clever, but they also reveal so much heart. What to drink? Ozone and squid. 6. The Memoirs of a Shy Pornographer by Kenneth Patchen. This novel was my white whale of literature for about 5 years. I read the title in the liner notes of a CD collection called The Beat Generation, but the book was out of print. I scouted it out at a used bookstore in Fort Lauderdale called All Books and Records, and after years of checking, I actually found the book there. This was before eBay and Half.com made shopping for used books infinitely easier. In 1999, New Directions re-released the novel, and while it has again gone out of print, used copies are not so difficult to obtain now. The Memoirs of a Shy Pornographer tells the story of Alfred Budd, a nice man who lives with his seamstress sister in Bivalve, New Jersey. When his novel, The Spool of Destiny, is mistranslated as The Spill of Desire, he becomes a worldwide sensation, and misadventures ensue. This is, in my fairly expert opinion, the first postmodern novel. What to drink? Champagne, of course. 7. The Lord of the Barnyard, Killing the Fatted Calf and Arming the Aware in the Corn Belt by Tristan E. Golf. This is one king hell of a novel, as if the essence of Mark Twain, Faulkner, James Joyce, Homer, and a little P.T. Barnum were somehow fueling a mad rocket shrieking to some interstellar space. It's one of those books that makes me howl, holy shit, where has this book been my whole life? Wild turkey, folks. Wild Turkey. 8. The Curse of Lono by Hunter S. Thompson. I'll admit that I adore Hunter S. Thompson and reread his work every year or so. While Gonzo fans idolize his 1970s work, I think that The Curse of Lono captures his voice as well as anything he wrote, and his focus is so imaginatively engaged that it may be his best work. Because it is so distractingly illustrated by Ralph Steadman throughout, awesome. And since the book is also interlarded with historical quotations about Hawaii, not so awesome, the sheer wonderfulness of the writing may be called into question. I don't know. I skip the quotations and read the text straight, and really, really love it. Pictures and pictures of Mai Tais. Number nine. Islands in the Stream by Ernest Hemingway. I have been told more than once that I should not like this book, but this may be my favorite Hemingway novel. That's right, Bob Lamb, my favorite Hemingway novel. It's one of his posthumous publications, but I find the psychological insight charming and the sense of place, Bimini and Cuba, to have almost no equal in literature. I also like the dialectic of drinking that Hemingway asserts in the novel. The drink I recommend is a Tom Collins, so central to the text as in this passage. Thomas Hudson took a sip of the ice-cold drink that tasted of the fresh green lime juice mixed with the tasteless coconut water that was still so much more full-bodied than any charged water, strong with the real Gordon's gin that made it alive to his tongue and rewarding to swallow, and all of it tautened by the bitters that gave it color. I can't stand coconut water anything, myself, but otherwise this recipe sounds like the palatable fireworks I so crave when I drink. But Hemingway also points out how difficult it is for Thomas Hudson to feel the relief and the pleasure of being drunk. The intrinsic quality of the drink is exquisite, but there is no extrinsic quality. Hudson's emotions are not altered or transcended. Drinking can only take one so far. 10. Guy's Psycho and the Ziggurat of Shame. What's that you say? It's not in print? Well then, dear listeners, write in to publishers and literary agents demanding that someone somewhere does publish my novel, which should be accompanied with Zacapa rum. All right. Last week, I talked a little bit about journaling, and I basically came to the conclusion, I think, that I don't know why I do it entirely. I do like to sort of keep a record of what I'm reading and what I've been up to, but I don't tend to record impressions except when I do. Lisa Roneik, who was our guest on episode 3, wrote in to say, I have 28 journals in book form. One is actually a bunch of paper collected in a box, but it's a pretty box. I started keeping a journal when I was in high school, and it was a traditional thing, an emotional outpouring about the traumas of adolescence. Eventually, I began taking notes about movies I saw, books I read, and artists whose work I encountered. I even have a couple of volumes of visual diary, sketches, collages, etc., but I have to admit that a lot of my journals remained emotional outpourings about love and loss of love. I wouldn't want anyone else to see them, though. They were a great reference when I was working on Sweet Invisible Body. Alas, the journaling impulse has more or less died out in me, or perhaps has just been channeled into stories, essays, poems, the blog, and Facebook. Maybe this is also because I got married, but I have this longing to still keep a journal. I think that I missed that private writing, and your comments about journaling made me think about that again. I really am curious now that I think of it, what Facebook might be doing to our writing, to our very conception of writing. If you have questions, comments, concerns, manifestos, interpretive dance that you've transcribed, please send them to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com and maybe I'll respond to them in a future mailbag segment. Well, that's all for today's show, folks. Keep your ass in the chair, keep attacking the keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Don't swallow the worm.
Don't swallow the worm.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.
Partner.
Parlay?
That's the one. Parlay! Parlay! Down to the depths, whatever mutton had thought of parlay.
French. Latin-based, of course. Inventors of mayonnaise.
Oh, I like mayonnaise.
Shame about the French, really. Obsessed with raisins. Humiliated grapes, really. Think about it.
Don't know.
Terrific singers, the French. Eunuchs, all of them.
That's not right. I used to date a eunuch.
I'll get me going.